What is it you want, Barry? What do you want? You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it and pull it down.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, dying time's here.
Come with me if you want to live.
That's it, man. Game over, man. Game over.
The Force will be with you. Always.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to 20th Century Geek. I'm your regular host, Scott Weatherly, and we are back in story time. And there's only one person I can share a story with, and that is Tony Farina. Tony, how are you doing, mate?
Hello. Our real future is coming to the present. It's coming to an end. The future is now.
I'm so excited.
This has been such a joy. I'm really so glad this all is because of... you know, this all came down to just Jack doing the stath, right? Because he did the remake of Death Race, and it just started, and I found that original Death Race, and so now here we are, and I'm just thrilled to death because I got to relive that, and we both own this amazing book.
Yes.
I know there's going to be a summer bonus story time that we'll save as a secret for later. But this has been a treat. I've been so excited. And it's just been, and this one, the one that we ended on, I kind of came at it like, oh, whatever. The movie is what it is. And I kind of have a soft spot in my heart for it. And this book is going to be lame. I flat out love the book. So I'm really excited to talk to you about it. I was so shocked.
This is where let's not bury the lead. We are talking This Island Earth.
Raymond F. Jones.
Yes, written in 1952.
About him.
Yes, I got some interesting thoughts about this guy. Yeah. And then obviously was made into a film in 1955. Very different. Well, no, they're sort of like they both start the same and then diverge dramatically. Like,
yeah, I'm curious what Jones thought of the film.
Yeah, not much, I can imagine. I know the film for two reasons. I think, you know, the name, but I also know because of what I thought was the alien from the film, the iconic sort of...
The big bug with the brain. Yeah,
almost
the mutant.
Yes, the mutant that, you know, seems very much to have inspired Mars Attacks, like that design.
100%.
But looks great. Is in it for like... I don't know, a minute and a half?
Maybe.
And the other thing is, I didn't actually get to watch much of it, but I did know that there was obviously a certain show that takes a mickey out of these films and did a special on This Island Earth. And we will touch on that as well.
Yes.
I'm like you. My understanding of this, of all the films we've done, and I knew we were. I think you and I were coming into this thinking, "Oh, this is going to be a laugh fest. It's going to be us ripping into this."
Yeah,
and I will in the film. Do not worry; like it fully deserves some of its reputation. But this book, I was not expecting, and you messaged me yesterday to be like, "Oh, this has been taken from liberally," and we will discuss that.
Yeah,
but the other thing I messaged you back today, and I was like, I was not expecting. Manufacturing structural sort of like discussions, and details of industrial action and how it was like,
and labor unions and the labor revolt. What the hell? What I mean, honestly, Scott, so many people owe Raymond Jones some money. Good Lord, I mean,
this book took me on a journey. I ain't gonna
lie. Me too. It's like, wow, so many people have just ripped him right off, and it was really ballsy, and I understand, I guess, why it hasn't stood up, but I feel like now it's 2024, like this book, and again, it's really hard to find. I did find an online version of it. This real fiction, of course, exists on the Internet Archive, so you can get the full book, but I actually did find a PDF version of it that I can give to you so you can include in the old show notes, and I sent it to Jack to read because he likes to read along. He just read Who Goes There? I saw, so I know he likes to read along, but like you've said this from the beginning, these stories are so hard to find and it doesn't make a lot of sense.
It does not. This one in particular does not make sense as to why this isn't I mean, you could release this as a novella, you know. Yeah. This and Who Goes There, and, you know, I think some of the others we've sort of just like, yeah, you know, a paperback, like just an anthology of just three novellas.
Yeah. Oh,
this,
easy. Yeah.
Even in this book, you've got this, Armageddon 2419, and Who Goes There, and then you're like, yeah, and this, and I'm just like, yeah. Yeah, I just want to say I'm sorry, but like, yeah, this book, just this is Forrest J. Ackerman and obviously and Jean Stein.
Yeah.
Real Future is a little gem of a find.
I know, $5. I bought it for $5. How much did you end up spending?
I think £10.
Amazing. I still couldn't believe I got it for $5. Mine,
and it's a really, and it's
mine even still has the dust jacket on it.
Yeah, I've got more than my dust jackets on the shelf over there at the moment.
It's insane.
It's,
yeah,
and it's in really good condition. So
yeah,
So enough about the story. So let's talk about the story. Let's talk about the story,
please.
So as you said, released in 1952, originally in a magazine form, and then was released subsequently later on in both hardback and paperback. The story follows a guy called Cal. You got to follow some of these characters. Called Cal Jones. Cal Meacham, who is basically like an engineering specialist at a research facility, and he gets sent a small part, so like a part that is usually massive, but they get sent this very, very small one, and he thinks it's a joke, and they test it and it works, and then they keep asking for more. They go back to the company that should have provided the original part. They have no idea. The order was never made to them, so they realize that someone's intercepting it, so they send it again to find more, and then they get sent a catalog of all these parts, and it's wacky. They go through and they're like, oh my god, this is crazy. Like, even the paper of this book feels wrong. It feels like it can't be
and
torn.
That is, like you said, the first, and then it's like the first 20 minutes of the movie are exactly the book. It's insane. Yeah. And then you're like, I said, and then it takes a turn. Yeah. But again, there's this mystery element. There's this like, ooh, what is it? It's a test. It's this. And so it's really compelling. Like, it's hard to stop reading because you're like, oh man. And it's so well paced. But then in true science fiction, like Asimov Clarkianness, it's like, I don't know anything about Raymond Jones, but I feel like he was an engineer too. Cause you know how, like, when you read Asimov, you're like, oh, you guys are like science. Pause, fiction. And Jones is like in that vein of like, you, by the time you're done, you feel like I could build an interaster.
Yes. Yeah.
I've got all the things I need.
Yeah. So this is what I love about this, because you said that this book takes, like, there's a twist and then there's another, and then they go, oh, you think you're settled? Oh no, there's another one. And then you go, oh, okay, I'll get the gist of this. Oh no, there's another one. Like this, what is it? Just over 100 pages in here.
I think it was originally, because it was published in three parts, it was serialized in three different magazines, so I'm assuming each of those twists were either like it ended a part and that was the twist surprise, or you know, and then you're like, oh shit, I gotta wait months, so it is it's about 100 pages in here because the book is oversized. It looks like if you buy the original when they first printed it, it was 220 like paperback pages,
which is about right. But yeah, no. What it's so basically, what it is, you've got this guy Cal. He's a curious engineer. He's a lot smarter than his job really requires, and so he sees that there is this thing within the catalog that he can sort of order all the parts for. Called, say it again, because I kept getting it wrong.
An interocitor,
and so he orders the part. And there's two or three. There's some lines in this which I actually laughed out loud at. Not because they are funny in the context of the story, just because I don't know, it made me laugh. The detailing, because it's clear like he's worked in like corporate engineering as well, because he orders it with no care for the budget or the organization. And then when he turns up, his friend Joe Wilson says, do you know what we got charged for this? And the guy's like, well, I don't know. Like, you know, I'm surprised it got through. And he's like, 2,800. And the guy's like, really? It should have been about 28,000. And I'm thinking, this is 1952. Like, that's a lot of money.
It is.
And then later on, he talks about not being able to get money for his projects. I'm like, yeah, I can see why, because you just keep ordering random shit from catalogs. Yeah. Like, you can't be trusted.
You can't be trusted.
But he builds this thing. He uses the catalog, which actually they recognize is actually an instructions manual, quite a complex instructions manual. But he uses it, creates this machine, and basically, I love the fact they're like, what does it do? I don't know. Better plug it in, and then it turns out to be a communications device.
Yeah. It was a test, and it was this most advanced communications device in the world. So it's like, again, at you, Roddenberry. Roddenberry read this and was like, I can do that. I can have us talk to a screen. Let's do that. Okay. I mean, steal.
Yeah. Oh, all cross. We'll keep getting. We should almost have like a ping every time we say something. I know. Here's everywhere else.
Yeah.
Right. Beep.
This is 1952.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so it turns out that this is where he ends up talking to somebody. He talks to this guy.
Jorgas Nova.
Jorgas Nova. I called him Jorgas Nova. Yeah,
that's right. There's an ARA at the end, but it doesn't. It's all fiction. It's a made-up word.
He sort of sneezed and hit the keyboard, I think. That's right. About how this name...
That was it. I guess that's it now.
Yeah. And he says, we are part of a secret organization, and we are offering you this opportunity to join us. And we know that you are curious, and you will take this opportunity to come and see the more advanced technology that you've seen in the catalog. You can come see the rest of it. And I want to sort of, that's a plane arrives and just whisks him away. And it's a pilotless plane. It's a drone.
Bing. It's unreal. Yeah. And they say, you know, it'll land and it'll leave 15 minutes without you. And they know. And the line that you said, the thing that you said about Cal is so right, because this, and again, when you read it, once you're like, whoa, there's this. But of course, because you said it perfectly, he's smarter than his job.
Yeah.
He's a corporate engineer. Most people, like, as a person who teaches in the liberal arts, I have to defend science all the time. People are like, oh, liberal arts. I'm like, science isn't liberal art. Science is an art. Science is creative. You think science is boring because that's what it is. But like, science is people don't become engineers so that they can just do the same shit over and over. They become engineers because they want to make something new. But we do this to people in the world. Capitalism makes you miserable.
Yes.
Right. You don't make money off of Cal Meacham, who's making something cool. You make money off Cal Meacham, who's a brilliant engineer who can make sure the shit I build works.
Yes.
And I want him to build it the same way for 50 years until somebody quits buying it, then we'll paint it yellow. And that'll be the only thing we do different. So I love what you said, is that he's smarter than his job. And that's so obvious. And that is also a comment. I mean, this is 1952. It's post-World War II. All these soldiers, they came back. And what did they do? They stood around and they worked in factories, or they worked, like, they moved into white collar offices, which killed their spirit. It's such comment. Yeah.
That's one of the things I think, because it starts with, and what I find interesting about this is that Cal is Cal Meacham is a fascinating character. But we don't start with him. We start with Joe Wilson, who is like basically from the procurement department. Like, he's from thinking, and he's watching out the window as somebody else is taking off on this plane and flies it off and brings it back, and he's like, oh, that's probably one of those fancy pants engineers doing their tests. But he always wanted to be like, to do something like that. He wanted to be something important, and now he's like, oh yeah, okay, well, I suppose, you know, but I am in this job, and I suppose I better sort of tolerate it. And I thought, it's kind of sad. It starts with that, and you just transition into Cal, and you sort of, Joe just becomes this like facilitator to allow Cal to get access to the parts. That's it. But it's Cal.
Joe Wilson. Yeah, it starts the offices of Joe Wilson, purchasing agent for Ryberg Instrument Corporation, looked out the company's private landing field. The company's again, that first sentence is doing a ton of work, right? And you learn later there's a thing about him. In that first paragraph, he chomps on a cigar. He's angry. He's wistful. Like, wow.
But the thing exactly. You get introduced to Cal. Now, the thing I want to say about the reason I find these two characters interesting is Joe's the kind of person that looks out the window wistfully. Cal's the person that gets on the plane.
Right. That's right.
And that's the difference between them. And that's like the lesson about this book. This story to me is, because it's all about predictability. It's all about doing the same thing, or is it? And so, you know, we'll get through that at the point at the end. But I just love that. That like the main, even at the start of this, like this story, the way it's written continually, like you're like, oh, I know why that that character's there to be this and that, and sort of like, you know, it's not, I didn't guess anything. There's a twist at the end. I completely didn't get. I was blown away by. So
yeah, again, brilliant. What I mean, brilliant. People owe him some money. Yeah.
Well, this idea. So let's just come to this idea of being tested by an external party to see if you are, you know, able to come join them. I'm thinking Last Starfighter, you know, Tomorrowland.
Dude, Last Starfighter, I was all about the Last Starfighter when I was reading this. Like, hot damn. Like, wow. I could not stop thinking, like, this is exactly what that is. And even The Matrix.
Yeah.
It's a test, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, we'll just keep saying, but yeah, I totally had Last Starfighter vibes. It was like, of course, whoever made that glorious film, 1984's Last Starfighter, which is, you know, I love that movie. Objectively love it. It probably doesn't hold up, but I don't want to know, because in my mind,
it's, you have an image of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I ever want to watch it again, because 12-year-old me loves that film. But because that's the ultimate thing. It's like, yeah, I'm a badass. Yeah, I could do this. And, you know, there was another film that is a hidden gem from the 80s. I don't know if you guys haven't done it, but maybe one day. Explorers with a Young River Phoenix and Ethan Hawke.
Yes, I do know. Yeah.
Oh my God. And same kind of thing. It's just like, we'll tinker. We're different. We're visionaries. We're trying something. You can't. We find something and we make something out of it because we can. And like you said, there's you can choose. Do you want to be a Joe Wilson or do you want to be a Cal Meacham? The names, even like Joe Wilson, you can't get more. They just were like,
relatively,
if I call it John Smith, it'll be too on the nose.
Yes.
But Joe Wilson, but Cal, what's that short for? Ooh, he's amazing. You know what I mean? Like, there's just like, even the linguistic nature of the names, it's just so good.
It's brilliant. Yeah. So yeah, he does. He gets taken to this place. He gets sort of jumps on the plane. He goes, and the explanation that, well, basically they say to him, we want to make more of these devices, and you are going to be a part of the team that's going to make them. Yep. And this is obviously where, you know, where again, we find out for the first part of the book, him passing this test and all this other stuff, I'm thinking Last Starfighter, Matrix is a really good shout. I'm thinking he's the one.
Right? 100%. Yep.
He's going to be the chosen one. He gets there and they're like, oh no, there's loads of us.
Yep.
You're
and
just doing this.
This woman. Yeah. And way amazing, way gender positive, right? Dr. Adams, she shows up. I mean, he does call her. Cal thinks of her. Raymond doesn't think of her as a girl. Cal calls her that girl with the doe eyes or whatever. But like, she holds her own. There's on more than one occasion where she's like, no, I'm going to do this thing. And then there's later in the book where Joe's like, I can't take you with me because I actually need you here to be competent. I can't have you with. If you're with me, then you can't do this other thing I need you to do. I trust you to do.
She is a love interest in the standard sense. They get married and this whole thing. Because this story covers quite a long period of time.
Yeah, I was not expecting that either. Yeah. I'm like, oh, they were spending years with Meacham.
Yeah,
I was not thinking that. Because again, I knew the movie first. The whole movie takes place in like 36 hours.
But she becomes competent. She's a part, like an integral part. And also, the thing is, like, he relies on her. Like, he's the one who'll say, like, what do you think? Like, they become a team. They are a partnership by the end, which I think is really cool. But you're right. But by sort of like chapter, like, I think, like, not two, I think it's supposed to be chapter three. They sort of like, there's a section where I think it's a bit later on, but basically, it's like, spent the next 6 months working.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh, right, cool. Fair enough. He basically just starts working on it, on these interocitors, and, you know, they're building a production line. It's all about setting up a factory. And you're just like, okay.
Cool. I was doing this before. Well, it's funny. And again, that's the bait and switch, because it's like you said, he's smarter than the job. We're bringing him here. He proves he can build this interocitor. Well, so now, do you want to spend the next 6 months just doing that same thing over and over? No, probably not. But that's what he does.
Yeah. Well, he basically keeps taking it apart and putting it together again. And yeah. They've put him in charge of the plant. Like, he is going to be in charge of the factory. And they've said, like, you tell us how the best way is that we can make this work here.
In Phoenix,
in the middle of nowhere, near Phoenix, because some of the staff live in Phoenix and some live on the camp or on this sort of campus that they've got set up. And there's this guy called the Engineer, and he is the head of this organization.
He's the Jorgen server number.
Yes,
we'll call him the Engineer because we can say that.
Yes, which is I also think these were called the Engineer because that's easier to write as well.
Yeah. I don't have to sneeze every time.
How did I spell that? Flick pages back to see
how it's spelled. I made a mistake.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? There's like an intermediary. There's a guy called Warner who's like the second in command. So the engineer's kept away. But eventually, sort of, Cal proves himself and the engineer decides to meet with him. And he explains that they are basically, and this word Tomorrowland shot into my brain. We are a secret organization of scientists and sort of intellectuals, and we are miles ahead technologically and scientifically than society and civilization, you know, and we have been holding things back. So basically, we have been conducting all this science, we've been doing all this experimentation and all this building so that we can get ahead, so we can then manage what gets released into the world. And he uses an example of, like, basically, we couldn't stop the creation of the atomic bomb at this point, but we did stop it from being built 40, 50 years before. Like, you know, so imagine if it was dropped in the Great War, in the First World War, rather than the Second World War. So you realize, and he also explains they've been around since the 17th century.
Right.
And you're like, oh, wow, okay, so this has been around for a long time. You know, he says, oh, it's come and gone, but generally it's always sort of been there. It's always been kind of there.
The peace engineers.
The peace engineers, yeah. They're always trying to sort of keep ahead of things and manage. So it's almost like the Illuminati of science. I was thinking, like, the amount of conspiracy theories that seem to have stolen from this book as well. And We'll get into that
100%. Yeah, like the whole plot of, we were talking off air about, like, pulp heroes and, like, the adventure, the Nicolas Cage, National Treasure movies. I'm like, oh, well, that's this. They whoever wrote that read this and was like, oh yeah, yeah. Instead of it being like that's 400 years of scientists, but that is kind of what it is. Like, that's the whole thing is, like, because there's all those Rube Goldberg things in there. Every time they solve a national treasure, it's like some weird sciencey thing that they invented. So science is at the root of it all. So yeah, I was like, wow, stole.
Yeah. Ding. So he has this thing, and they're like, oh, he feels he is on a footing for good. Like, he realizes that this is, you know, maybe they're about to go onto the next leap and they're going to start releasing these interosters into the world, and this is the next technological thing. And then he's also been introduced to Ruth, who he has taken an interest in, but also his old friend, Ol, who is a Swedish guy.
He definitely ran out of names for that one. Ol Swenberg. Like, what?
Yeah.
What? We were going to call him Sweetie McSwedenberg, but they were like, that's a little on the nose. Well, Ol Swenberg. And he's huge, right? He's a big old Swede. I mean, he's everything you could imagine he'd be. And they were roommates in college.
Yes. So they've known each other for a long time, and that's what I like. And they met at you know, they've since then, they've sort of met at some conventions and stuff like that. So they've known each other for years, but, like, it's been quite a distant sort of friendship, and they bump into each other because they move in similar circles. So anyway, apparently at some point, Ol has an episode of you know, and he says something to Ruth about having seen something in the sky, and so they start having this conspiracy of that this isn't all it appears to be. And so, but they don't want to approach Warner or the engineer or anything. So they've got to find evidence of what it is that is actually going on. And so they do, they start digging. And then one night they stay behind and hide in the factory, and they see a flying saucer.
Sure.
In the
park. Now it's something else.
Yeah, exactly. And this is it. Woof, we're off to something else. Can I also say how much I loved that, like, you know, it's never said, but the flying saucer literally lands in the docking area.
Right. Of course. Like,
oh, yeah, of course it does. That's, you know. Yeah. And it is taking, but this is the point, it is taking some of these.
Because they don't know, because the question is, it all starts because it's like, again, you talked about it, the amount of like mundanity that makes things happen. It's like, again, you go back to Jill Wilson, like you need a Jill Wilson. You need somebody who's like keeping track of things because they're like, you're making all these interrosters for all these months, Cal. And he's like, yeah, you're like, where are they going?
Like, 600 yeah. a month is
where did yeah where are they going? Who he's like, I don't know, trucks. He's like, where do the trucks go? When is it? And like, because Cal's not thinking, he's not that kind
of. He's
thinker.
An engineer. He's not
interested. Right. He doesn't think about. He's like, that's somebody else's job. They don't come and do that. I'm not going to tell the shipping guy how to do his job. But then you find out that they're being flown out on this, and that's like, oh shit, we're building shit for aliens.
What is it?
Yeah, what is it? What do they need it for? Why do they want the interrosters? And then you get just this thing.
Then, like I say, then it's been notched up a level. Now it's no longer Tomorrowland. It's like, well, are we now building things for aliens? And then so it builds, and we get the next thing is we find out that the interrositor itself, when tuned in differently, not only is a communication device, it can share thoughts and it can pick up people's thoughts. And Ruth, in trying to get one of the machines to work, picks up the thoughts of the engineer and hears something about what is being these are being used for. And she hears directions being sent and something about the outer rim and all this other stuff. So they start to dig and dig, and they get caught digging, basically. And again,
when there's a machine that can read thoughts.
Yes, yes.
Think that through a little, people. Yeah. Aren't you smart?
But they use it a few times, don't they? I like the fact that they do, I like the fact that there are rules. The Interoster has rules.
Yes.
So it's about a beam that allows you to connect to other devices. But if you leave that beam fuzzy, it means that your thoughts and your images are being pushed out and they can be picked up. So the idea is to get the image and everything, not just the image, but the thing as sharp as possible, because you are then machine to machine. That's the idea. And that's how you end up picking up thoughts when you keep it fuzzy almost. Anyway, we then learn the engineer pulls them in again, because we're thinking, oh my God, they are the baddies. They've been working for, you know, this is almost V now. We're now working for an alien force, and we didn't realize we were working for the baddies.
Yeah.
And so the engineer confronts him and says, well, no, we're not the baddies. We know what you're thinking. Actually, you're an outpost and manufacturing outpost for an intergalactic war that you are massively unaware of. And we are
the Lanas and the Guaras.
Yes. So we are part of the Lana Council, which is a confederation of sentient beings from different planets that have been fighting against these Guaras. And you know nothing about the Guaras other than they are an evil force that is basically spreading through the the whole fascist kind of this
there's a lot of that. Well, there's, again, we talked about this with the thing, there's a lot of like commentary on, you know, what how did we get, because this is taking place after World War II, but it's commentary on World War I and World War II, but that post-war stuff, and the Cold War is now starting, and it's like hiding in plain sight, the things you don't know who you're working for. There's a lot of Overton window happening, like, this is what we do, and then we're just used to that.
And it comes in later. I mean, they talk about red agitators, communist agitators later on. I mean, it literally gets talked about.
I know, and then there's like the proletariat uprising, and there's like a union strike that happens in here, and you're like, what the fuck is going on?
Well,
in
I love the story. This is where the name of the book comes from.
Right.
And this is why I love this story so much now, is because you think this is starting as a chosen one, almost like a white savior.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Even Cal thinks that at one point.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, they played him the whole time.
Yeah.
He is a fiddle. Yes. They are playing the shit out of him, and a way to take him. And again, that is so not done. You don't play the hero like that. And they do. Like, at no point in time is he ever in any control at all.
No.
But he thinks he is. But he is.
Yes.
When you are the smartest, tallest, whitest guy in every room, you think you're in charge. And then you're like, oh, hold my interlocutor. You are not.
Well, that, yeah. That's why it makes me chuckle. Because, again, like you say, it keeps telling you what the people are and then going, ah, but they're not. Right. So you do. You find out then that there's this entire intergalactic, like interstellar war going on. And I wanted to touch on this because basically what we learned is this island Earth is we are a manufacturing outpost. And the reason that we have been chosen is because we are so oblivious to what's going on in the universe. And we're so far away from the war and we are so insignificant that we're kind of a safe place to build stuff.
Right. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. And that's what we, and again, even the choice of like where they said this, north of Phoenix in the desert.
Yeah.
Even there, it's like, and that is where we do things still. Like, I actually just heard a story this morning about like, you know, the way that they're going to start doing carbon capture for gas and coal plants is they're going to capture the stuff. It's not going to go in the sky. They're going to capture it. And then they're going to take it out to the desert and they're going to bury it because there's nothing there. They're like, well, something, I mean, maybe something is there. But again, like, but that's, it's that conversation of like, that's how we treat stuff. So this is like, even there's this environmental awareness that's happening in here. Because like you said, we're so insignificant. We're this little remote, like, again, they compare us to a Pacific island. But, you know, people live on that Pacific island. Like, you can't just be like, I'm going to dump my garbage here. That's but that's how we're treated. And it's so smart.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
Silly. Yeah.
So I love the fact that this is what it is. And there's all this stuff. And Cal sort of kind of gets pissed off about it at first. And because I think he said, because Ol learns about it and Ruth learns about it. And I love, there's a moment where they say about, you were going to get either frustrated and walk out, or you're going to want to punch someone in the nose. Because you realize that, yeah, you're not the main character of this story anymore.
No.
In fact, you are not
at all.
You're a side quest at best.
Right. And you're not even a side, right? At best, because you're not really even a side quest. You're a drone. And it goes back to, and of course, that's why there's like a union uprising and there's a worker revolt, because again, that it starts with that theme is running through it. He's bored at work. His talents aren't being used. He gets rewarded. They bring him to a place and then they just have him run a factory where his talents aren't thing. And then it turns out the whole thing is that, like, not just Cal, but the greatest minds on earth, not just in America, the greatest minds on earth are nothing more than Joe Wilson.
Yes. For an alien intergalactic race.
100%. Right. And you're like, fuck.
And this is where you said about the language and the comparisons is made in this book. The engineer explains this to the three of them, all Ruth and Cal, as basically saying, look, think about it this way. During the war, you were on some of those Pacific islands and you basically utilized native tribes in there to cut down trees to make way for landing roads. You're those native tribes.
Right.
That's all you are.
All you are. Yep. You're just livestock and again, this has been Douglas Adams read this, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. This is where the bureaucracy of this.
I mean, Douglas Adams read this. Like, there's no doubt that Douglas Adams was like, oh, yeah. And it's just, again, every time I read everything I read, I'm like, oh, yep. And now whether everybody read, like, because we know that Gaiman and Pratchett and everybody, they read Adams. So they may not have read this, but like Douglas Adams fucking read the shit out of this. And he's like, because when you think about, I mean, that's the beautiful thing. The first, you can never go back and reread read Hitchhiker's Guide for the first time ever again. But the first time you read Hitchhiker's Guide and you're just like, oh, oh, that's what we are. We're nothing. We're dumb, little nothings. And this is that.
And this is it. I think this is, I just want to read some of the, because some lines coming up that I really want to read. So, so this is sort of like, you know, you're the engineer, or Jürgen, Dr. Jürgen. So Cal's learned this. He says, you're at war. Cal leaned forward abruptly. You let us overhear snatches of reports passing between you and others of your group. Why? We wanted you to know about it. So they think they're onto something. This is, again, you said they always think they're in control. Ruth thinks she stumbled across this information. Oh, no. Because they know how to use these machines so they let it be fuzzy so that they would pick up the information. To what purpose? If you intend to involve Earth or want our help in some capacity, why didn't you simply say so? Again, this grandiose idea that we can help in this interstellar war. We had to find out about you, that you three. We had to know your reaction. We had to know how much you hate war. And this is obviously this post-war, anti-war kind of thing.
Right, of course.
We gave you the clues and watched of all those to whom we worked. Your reaction has been the most satisfactory. We are ready to ask if you will help us. How and why? Why should we involve ourselves in Earth in something that is no concern of ours? That's Cal sort of going, why should we bother? Jorgens Nova hesitated, speculating as if wondering what kind of analysis Cal would comprehend. You have had experience during your own recent world war. You saw how the waves of battle washed back and forth over primitive people who had little or no comprehension of who was fighting or what purpose. So he's literally saying, like, you're the ants in this situation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, and again, it's like when you think about Adam says, like, Adam's whole point is like, Earth is just a ruse. Right,
yeah.
Like that at the end of that, like Doug Adams is like, Earth is a joke. It's a pit stop along the way to something else, and it was like an afterthought of something else. They're like Earth, and we're like, we're awesome, we're so great, and of course, so much science fiction is that, you know, the reason that I prefer science fiction to fantasy is because I feel science fiction is waxing philosophical, whereas fantasy is not like, I don't, yeah. Like it, you know, there are places where they merge, and of course I do like some high fantasy, but like in its core, good science fiction is commenting on, like, Ursula K. Le Guin always says, science fiction writers, we're not really writing about the future, we're writing about now, but it just seems like we're writing about the future. And that's what so he's commenting on this. It's like a real, they're called the peace engineers. Again, the language, they're called the peace engineers. Why? Because then Cal and Ruth believe it. Yeah. They're like, well, they called themselves the peace engineers because no one would lie to me. I'm Cal Meacham. You know, and you're just like, oh, JK.
Well, he even says that several times. Why would they lie? And Ruth's the one going, are you serious?
Right.
Like,
stupid man.
Yeah. She gets very frustrated with him towards the end. There's another paragraph, a very short sentence I want to read.
Yeah.
This is, again, the engineer speaking to Cal. It is possible that the people of your planet would never know that this war had ever raged, regardless of the outcome. You would be of no concern to the enemy. He has higher goals than the conquest of your little world. Yeah.
Okay, so here's the one thing I did learn. And so that's a moment. Let's stop there for just a second. Mm-hmm. The one thing I know for sure about our friend is he was a Mormon.
Right.
So now there's this weird thing about Mormons. I'm not here to shit on Mormonism, whatever. People believe what you want to believe. But there's like, because Mormonism is an American religion. It's about, you know, like Jesus coming to America and leaving some, I don't know, gold plates around, and Joseph Smith finds him in a cave, whatever. It's very, you know, it's a lot of stuff. Anyway, but like, or Scott Card, Stephanie Meyer. There's like all these Mormons who go on to write science fiction. And of course, you know, like there's that commentating on humans getting a little too big for their britches, and like, it's really smart and everything, but there's this, what I didn't know he was, I wouldn't have read Mormonism, but then once I looked him up after I finished reading, I'm like, who the fuck is this guy? Why do I not know who he is? Why am I not teaching him in class? What am I missing? And to find out he's a Mormon. And so I just wondered, like, do you, that line that you just read, is that is this, like, you know, if you're thinking Mormonism, like, God is bigger than you. And obviously he's believing in aliens, so there's that other conversation about that. But is that what that is? Because that's what all of Ender's Game is. I mean, Ender's Game is stolen this too. And it's another Mormon stealing from this Mormon. But clearly the Ender's Game,
it feels like that. I mean, it keeps going in that vein, doesn't it? We are small. We are not a big, and especially the end, which we'll get to shortly. But I think you're right. The one thing I want to highlight about this information is, because this is where we get a twist, this is the second, we now learn that there's this interstellar war, and there's all stuff going on, and we are then going to, this is where we literally, you think, reading this, oh shit, we're about to kick it up a notch, we're about to kick this up into next gear, we're going to start flying X-Wings and, you know, nuke it from space, it's the only way to be sure, and all that kind of stuff. because you get a lot. This is, and this is, you get hints. This is what I'm saying. You get hints of what this war is, but you never see it. And this right. is a line that I want. I just want to read this short paragraph. And then there was a battle. Like a spark, it began and ignited the whole of space. Vast forces that twisted and wove the fabric of space itself engulfed the ships, imprisoning them in webs of impenetrable time and space and turning their crews into screaming things that would live forever. Jesus Christ, that is horrific impressive. And I'm going, what the hell? This is like, you know, Warhammer 40K kind of stuff.
It's terrifying.
That's going on. And we're like,
yeah.
And I'm thinking, okay, where are we going? Where are we going? Labor unions.
Right. What? Yeah. But it makes perfect sense, though, it too, does. because again, there's you're being exploited. Like, people yes. are being exploited. The rich Western white people and the rich Western Eastern folks during World War II, they exploited anybody they could. Like, I had a friend in college. He's Korean. I'm telling you, they are not getting over it anytime soon. Like, mm-mm. the Koreans and the Japanese aren't going to be friends anytime soon. It's yeah. never going to happen. And it's like, and not for like more generations, because even Ted, who's our age, he's still mad. And I was like, dude, you were born in Seoul and you moved here when you were four. Like, you grew up outside of Detroit. You have a sister called Leah. Like, her middle name is Bunny. She's American. Like, you, I mean, yes, she's Korean, but you know, like,
yeah,
but that rage, both Leah and his little brother Sean and himself, they all still had that, like, you know, goddamn the imperialist Japanese, whatever. I'm like, well, that's not them now, but it doesn't matter. Yeah. They can't let that go. So because all throughout war, you're always exploiting somebody. You're always shooting on somebody. And what can they do? They got to band together. They got to fight. They're going to revolt. They're going to sit in. Like right now, and I don't know if it's spread to Europe, but like a lot of American universities like are shutting down right now because the students are protesting. They're just like, fuck this. The Gaza war has gone on too long. We can't handle this. We're just going to sit. Like, some schools have just canceled finals.
Yeah, Columbia.
One school canceled. Yeah, canceled graduation. They're not even going to have a graduation ceremony. I think USC, because they're like, what are we going to do? And so again, what happens when you feel insignificant, when you feel pushed, when there's nothing you can do, you band together and try to raise a ruckus. Now, in the grand scheme of things, this war doesn't mean anything. Even if you're aware of the war, you still can't process it. So you still feel like you need to do something, because humans in the capitalistic society are not comfortable just existing. You and I were talking about off air about like the essays you're writing. I'm like, if I could pay you to write that essay, I would pay you to, I would just pay you to do that. I would just sit and write and think big thoughts. And there's people who want to go make money and do stuff, right? Mm. There's people who want to, like, the world will keep running because people want to do that. But like, art matters too. People need entertainment. We want to be part of that. That's our contribution, but we can't.
No.
We got to be cogs. But it's also like, so what do you do when you're frustrated by being beaten down? You join together and you try to revolt. So it makes perfect sense. But when I got there, like, what? Is there seriously like 20 pages of union strike happening in the middle of this book? What the fuck?
It's amazing. I love it.
It is.
But it comes, because it comes down to, like, again, this is what, when Cal starts, every time Cal has to recalibrate his position in this.
Yeah.
Because they literally give him a choice. They're like, well, you can carry on and we're going to do this thing. But like, so it becomes a story about the home front to me. This is like, okay, World War II, the home front. You cannot contribute to the war, the front line.
Right.
But you can create, you know, these interactions.
Victory garden.
Yeah, exactly. You can create these things. So you're, you know, building for Britain and all that kind of stuff. Like, you know, that's what this is. And so Cal's like, cool, then all my energy goes into making this as productive as possible. So they start to do that. And they obviously, you know, all has disappeared. There's a whole sort of thing there. But the union thing comes about because they are making things more efficient.
Right.
And again, I think this is a comment on the post-World War II Japanese, that they were becoming more efficient, and they talk about automation and all this other stuff. So there's all these kinds of things being talked about. But they talk about this idea, and this is what I find interesting for this section, because you say it's about labor movement, but they boil it down to the fraternity and frustration of the worker. As you said, they're all clubbing together. And they look for a purpose. There's like this thing of resenting the fact that you are just a cog in a machine and you're not an individual. And there's a great line where he says, basically, 9 out of 10 people end up getting to a job and they hate it.
Yeah.
They don't want to do that. So, but they'll become good at it. And then, but they need a vent. So every now and then, the union will sort of flare up and we have industrial action. We go through the motions. They feel better. They go back to work. That's the sort of the notion. And they're waiting for a reason to vent. And it comes
right.
this one guy has been, his job role has been changed. He was a sort of a nut and bolt man. Okay. But they've automated that now. And now he needs to be able to use a soldering iron and he can't use a soldering iron. So they've let him go. And so the union comes in and starts kicking off and saying, we're going on strike because you tricked this guy. He can't do the job. You've got to, you know, you need to have employment and stuff. So they go on strike. And then you have this conversation about Cal starts explaining industrial action to these aliens.
Right.
Because the aliens are going, we don't have this anywhere else in the galaxy, in any of the galaxies that we work in. Just here. What?
Right.
What's wrong with you?
Right. I know. What it's. And again, there's a line in there that made me burst out laughing. So as a person who is a teacher who struggles with the teachers union a little bit, because it's like, do I think the coal miners need a union? Yes, I do. Mm. Do I think the auto workers need a union? Yes, I do. Do I understand that teachers, we work really long hours and we don't get paid for those hours? And if you break down what you get paid, and then people are like, you get summers off. Sure. But you're also working like 14-hour days during the 9 months, 10 months a year that you are working. So like you get paid like 15 cents an hour is what it breaks down to some days, right? You know, whatever. So I have a uncomfortable relationship with
this. There's a tension there with it. Yeah.
Correct. Me personally. But there's a line in there, and I'm pretty sure it's Cal who says it when the union starts happening. And he's like essentially says, and I should have highlighted it, but essentially says like, well, they're just like ingrateful bitches.
Yeah,
how dare they? Like, and it's like, wow. And I laughed because I was like, wait, you're the boss saying that. Like, you're not the person. But I also understand, as somebody who isn't the boss, who sometimes is like, when like the universities in particular, when like my job is stressful and I work at a university, and I'm not saying it's perfect in any stretch of the imagination, and there's always problems wherever you work, but like when university professors go on strike, like let's take that down to like 3 from 11, because it's not, you're not high school teachers, you're not elementary school teachers, it's a totally different situation. It's not mandatory, like every 11-year-old has to go to school in America. But every, you know, 19-year-old doesn't have to go to college. Like, that's a choice. So it's a different situation. So it's always like, maybe you're being a little like, yes, complain to your boss, do some work, get better pay, do that stuff. But like, go on strike. Those kids are literally paying your salary because that's how their tuition
works.
But it was just funny. I like laughed out loud. I was reading it. I was like, oh my God, I didn't realize like Cal was going to be a union buster for a minute. Like, what the fuck?
Raymond Jones has quite strong views on unions.
He sure does. Wow.
Because that's the point, though. He says, you know, because at one point, like, the engineer's like, we don't get this. Like,
right.
You know, you should be clubbing together, you know, and then this idea of fraternity, of coming together for a cause. But Cal makes a good point. He's like, yeah, but I can't tell them the cause.
Right.
We can't tell them this is for an interstellar war. They don't really know what it is they're building. They just do their job.
Right.
And when there's, you know, when there's a lack of information or a lack of communication, they get antsy and they get, you know, nervous. And so the strike comes about. But there's definitely the feeling of, ugh, unions.
I know. It was like really, and I couldn't, because again, it was like, it was both things. It was like, well, of course this is inevitable and people like all of that. And then it's also like, these ingrates. You're like, wait, which is it? But again, I do think that's really but on reflection, because in the moment I just kind of laughed and was like going along for the ride and having way more fun with this book than I thought I was going to have. And like really, but then upon reflection, I'm like, oh, that's the point.
Mm.
He wants us to feel conflicted. There's a thing about showing both sides, and then there's both sidesism, right? Like both sidesism is bullshit. That's what Trump does. Both sidesism is what certain people say. They're like, well, if we let a gay person talk, then we have to do both sides. No, you talking, straight white man, is the other side. You standing up here saying, we ought to have the other side. The fact that you have the microphone, you're already represented. So you don't have to say, if we let a queer person talk, we have to let a straight person talk. Because 90% of the people are straight people talking. So you already have the other side. So like, both sidesism is bullshit. But having a conversation about opposing points of view is what really good philosophical science fiction does. And that's what this does. It's like, oh, I walked away thinking like, oh, this, I agree. I think he's probably pretty anti-union, but at least he was open to saying, like, he put, you know, he's like showed the dissenting opinion. It's like, this is, these people had a valid concern. That guy, you know, Mr. Charlie Bucket's dad has a really, has a concern about his job being taken away. God damn it. And I think that is valid and he shows it. So no matter where you are, you can leave the book going, huh, I'm going to have a conversation about fucking labor unions now on this island Earth. Who knew?
But he comes away and it then gets to industrial structures as well and how to deal with labor unions. Because he says the bigger a thing is, the more likely you are to have this, you know, lack of engagement, and that, you know, this sort of thing is always going to result. He says it's inevitable. The bigger the factory, the bigger the plant, the more likely this is to happen. And also, we can't keep this secret anymore. Because if they kick off with industrial action, then the media gets involved and government agencies get involved, and all of a sudden we have to justify what it is we're doing in this factory.
Right.
We can't have that. So they start to struggle with this fact that they've got to keep it secret. And but Cal's solution is really interesting because he's like, well, we've got to diversify this. We've got to sort of like break this down into little chunks. You know, you've got everything centralized in this one plant. We've got to break this down. So we've got like manufacturing hubs in places or manufacturing centers that then all the parts get brought together to be put together for an assembling hub. And he says that way, you know, they're too small to have a union and stuff. Like, you know, there won't be that
percent. Because you're only making the wheel. You don't know. Right, and that's it. And there's only 15 of you, so that's, you don't, I know.
And they go on an international tour. Like, they literally listen to all these countries. They go, you know, they go to South America, they go to Europe, they go to France and England, they go to Dakar. Go to the Ivory Coast. They literally have some people making things out of ivory, which is suspect at the best times. But like, yeah, they go through this thing, and he's like, "Well, you, look, what you've got there with all these small hubs is what you need here. This is how we break the unions: is that we break them up and we have the assembled on assembled." And this is the bit where this is again like we get a slightly another twist, really. Because then you sort of realize that we've talked about the Lana Council.
Yeah.
So the engineer is not in charge. He's just another cog in a large, everyone has a boss.
Yes. And everyone does have a boss.
Yeah. And Cal sort of calls it out. He says, you put me in charge of, literally, they were going to put Cal in charge of global manufacturing for Earth and all this other stuff, which is why they went on this international tour. But he's not allowed to make decisions. He has to escalate them to the engineer, and the engineer then takes them to the Lana Council. And so Cal has a bit of an outburst where he's like, no, screw you then. If you're not going to let me do this myself, I'm done. I'm out. And they've gone to point this way. I should say, this argument happens on the moon. I forgot to mention that part.
Right. The backside of the moon, Luna, is where they are from, where they live. Where they have a hub.
They have a base there. This is where the Lunar Council
exists.
And
the dark side of the moon. The reason the dark side of the moon is there. And again, how many movies have stolen that?
Transformers, Dark Side of the Moon. Bing! There you go.
Yeah, that movie, that one really shitty movie with Patrick Wilson and
Moon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, was it just called Moon?
Moonfall? Moonfall. Oh, yes.
With him and Halle Berry. That movie was god awful. But boy, did it know it. I don't know that it knew it was bad. I thought it was terrible. Yeah. But also, Dark Side of the Moon. That was the one where the moon is hollow.
Yes.
The moon is actually a satellite and there's secret aliens. So again, bing, just steal, steal, steal. Yeah, so right. You forgot to mention that they're on the dark. And again, the Overton window of what Cal's willing to accept. Because his first, like, oh, this. He's like, oh, that's shocking. And he's like, oh, I guess. And now this. Now he's like on the moon. And he's like, this is it. I'm going to leave. Where are you going to go?
Yeah.
See ya. We own you now, Cal. So it is. It's funny. And the things
you
that
say
you're willing
that,
to accept.
Yeah, but you're right there. That's another thing, because he does. He storms out after having this conversation. He's like, well, if I can't control the way things are going to be done on Earth, because you don't really understand how humans work, Earthmen work, psychologically, because that's where you find out that actually that's why Ruth's around. She's a psychiatrist, and she's been hired so that they can understand how people work. So they can
make,
and that's fantastic. He storms out, and she, you know, he calms down a little bit. And when Ruth comes, then they're now married by this point.
Yes.
And she says, like, you realize there's no walking away from this. And right. he's like, no, I realize that. Like, you know, yeah.
I just needed to throw a fit.
I just needed to throw my toys at the pram, but we're all good now. Let's carry on.
Oh, it's again, what a roller coaster. Yeah. And for, to find out that Ruth is there, how all the things she is, and that she's there, she's essentially like, you know, mind control a little bit. Like she's not, but she also, she's way more not invested, but just like, except she's like, this is it. Like she's found out that there's an interstellar war and that humans are insignificant and was like, right. Okay. So what do I do to make the best of that? Like she, and again, a commentary on the only mom in the building, like on the Wendy factor, right? On the idea, now that was written before this, but the idea of there's a woman in charge, even though she's not in charge, even though he calls her dear and like, you know, darling. Pats her ass and darling, whatever. But she's clearly the boss. And that is the family dynamic of all things. You and I were talking off air about like decisions we make in our lives that our wives agree with, which really is us saying like, would that be okay? Like we want them to approve of the things we're doing and they're very supportive and we are lucky men.
Yes.
But that is also the dynamic because we're not misogynist pricks. We're feminists. So we're like, yes, of course. And like you said, your wife's going to go to the continent for a week and you're just like, she's awesome. Yeah. That's it. You're not like, well, who's going to, you can't be, who's going to be your chaperone? You know what I mean? Yeah. So like, we're not like, but the fact that that commentary is here is that on the guise of all these like men and male type characters, because all the alien characters are very male, there's the one woman who's really the only one who knows what the fuck is going on, and again way ahead of its time
for
to have that commentary there.
Well, there's a line at one point where you kind of feel like, is it being misogynistic? And then it's like she just becomes so integral to the thing when they when they first get together and they go out for dinner and he picks her up and it says something like, Cal couldn't imagine, she's wearing like a gray evening dress and a corsage and stuff. And it says, Cal couldn't imagine an MD or PhD in that dress.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, you're chauvinist, but like,
right.
But by the end of the book, he's talking to her and saying, we have this massive interstellar problem. What do we do? What do we do?
Right. She's the one. And she's not, again, she's duped by the final turn.
Yes.
Everybody's duped by the final turn. I was duped by the final turn. But then once you know the final turn, which we should tell everybody, spoiler, if you haven't read the book by this point in time, the big final turn is coming. And again, John Carpenter read this.
Yep.
The final turn is that Ole is a fucking sleeper agent and has been a sleeper agent whole fucking time. It was the long game.
Yeah.
Since college, it wasn't like the whole mind warp thing. It wasn't that his mind got warped in the way they think. It's that he's programming, like they were fighting his whatever, you know, his program. They were trying to like reprogram, but because he's not human and he's not Lanin, he's Gwaren.
Yeah.
And so
he's a human looking alien. Jesus who's been living on Earth for decades.
Yeah, for this purpose.
Yeah.
It's like he was put there on purpose in Cal's way.
But it comes down to this whole point we will get to in a minute. Because the other thing that happens as well is there's an announcement that comes when they're while they're on the moon that they've had there's this chart that shows the battle lines, very much like World War II or World War One. You know, here's the trenches, here's where our battle front
is.
And all of a sudden, there's an announcement that the Gwari have broken through. But instead of doing what was predicted, which is what we'll get, you know, the predictability of this, they've actually changed direction and they are heading for Earth.
Right.
And like,
dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. And but the Lana Council can't fathom this. They don't understand it. Because at one point, they think it's because of this Interocitor production.
Right.
But then they're going, but you may be one of the better production men, but we've got loads of them.
Right.
You've literally got these all over the place in different galaxies, different solar systems. So we don't know why they're targeting Earth. We don't know. And because they can't figure this out, like it's thrown them for a loop. And so, but that's where this whole thing comes about because at the end, and this work ties into the union disputes.
It does.
Someone comes in and smashes up all the machines. And Cal thinks it's the union, but yeah, he thinks it's been right. The union. He thinks this is industrial sort of sabotage. And when the union guy comes in, he's saying, well, you don't know, this could have been communist saboteurs or...
Right, of course it was. The Red Scare, they're hiding in plain sight too.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the whole plot of the Americans.
And Cal's just like, no, it was always you. And they have this whole argument where he says, like, we might not even open the plant, sodger. Like, you're done. He has like a proper, like, Cal is very impulsive at times.
I can't, I know.
But then we find out that it wasn't. It was Ol and these two aliens. These stinky aliens, these stinky, scaly aliens exist in these transparent sort of plastic suits. And I'm loving all this. Where I'm like, oh, shit, the alien stuff has come to Earth. This is great.
Been there the whole time.
Yeah. And I love it. We find out that Ol... has been a sleeper agent, or has been at least been a sort of a double agent. He was brought in by the Lana Council and has tricked them, but has always been placed there by the
group. Always tricked them from the beginning. Yeah. That is a long con.
And he tries to kill. He basically beats a cow over the head with something.
And he kills the engineer.
Yeah. And so there's this whole thing then of basically, look, they're coming. We now know that they've been shipping off information to the enemy. We don't know why they're coming to Earth. We don't know what to do about it, so we're doing one. We're leaving. We're going to basically abandon Earth to the Guara, and we're leaving to set up production elsewhere. Like, we're nothing more than an abandoned factory to them. And this is where I'm like, oh my God, these cold-hearted, like, they're proper cold. Because it also describes what the Guara are going to do to Earth.
Right.
And they're like, because, you know, again, this is, and this has been happening all over the place. And there's a lovely line comes later, but which I'll mention. The Guara are going to turn up, surround the planet, and basically blast it with fire, and everyone's dead in a couple of hours.
Literally hell on Earth.
Yeah. Everyone's gone. Nothing survives. And there's a moment when Ruth confronts Warner, who was the engineer's sort of right-hand man, and says...
Yeah.
How can you? You don't know what this is that we're feeling. How can you leave planet Earth to this fate? And he just says, "I know exactly what you're going through. This happened to my planet 30 years ago."
Dun dun dun.
And you're just like,
"Fuck!"
And she's like, "Oh, I'm so sorry."
Yeah.
And he's like, "Oh." And there's this moment of like, "Oh, we're not special." There's been the planets full of sentient life that have been absolutely decimated by this war, and we've been untouched. We are just one in millions.
Again, you think of another, you know, when you think of what the xenomorphs are, right? That's all they are. They show up. And again, it's a little more visceral, but that's their whole thing. That's all they are, the alien, and I know the alien doesn't have a name, xenomorph, that's later, that's added later, but the alien in Alien, their whole thing is to just be, they come in, they destroy, and when it's done, they move on to the next planet. They move, that's all they do. And again, this goes back to the thing from the other planet, the thing, this is the same thing. It's like, you are a parasite. You are sucking things dry, and you're moving on to kill the next thing, because that's what you do.
I mean, it's capitalism.
You
know, all right, we're not going to make money here anymore. Move on. Leave it. Well, we ignore the workforce that we're leaving behind, the families. You know, we're going to go somewhere cheaper. We're moving our...
Yeah, well, that's... Yeah, I mean, you think about what... In America, we call it the Rust Belt. And I know guys have parts of... You have parts of your country, too.
We have Wales.
Like, you have Wales. I was just going to say, oh, poor Wales.
But the coal industry, the mining, you know, the mining industry, but the manufacturing of the Midlands, Wolverhampton and the Black Country, same thing.
Yeah.
But they're like, yeah, but why would you manufacture there when we can manufacture in China or India for, you know,
We don't have to see the exploitation of the children and the destroying of the land. It looks nicer here now that there's nobody left and we've blown the top of the mountain off. Everything's fine. Yeah, I know. It is a journey.
Oh, God, this book blew my mind.
The end is, though, and again, this is where humans get to be special.
Yes.
Jones
throws us a bone.
He does us a bone at the end, and this is where him being like a Mormon, I guess, comes in. Him being like, well, humans are fine. The Lanans decide to trick the Guarans, and the one thing they didn't expect is a defense, because they've not done it before. Every time this happens, they run. So they're going to turn, and they're going to defend Earth.
Let's put it into context, though, because what happens is Cal, again, being the engineer, decides, I'm not accepting this. I'm going to go. And we find he's an obsessive. That's what Cal is. Cal's an obsessive.
Sure. That's well said. Yeah.
He was an obsessive that he's built. That's why he built the Interocitor and everything else. He looks at the full history of all the wars between the Lana and the Guara and starts looking at all the battle plans and all this other stuff. And he can't figure all this out. He's like, what? How come the same thing happens again and again? They attack, you retreat, or you attack and they do this. And Warner explains, well, we've got these, basically, like these quantum computers that has all the information of all the AI. Basically has all the information in the thing.
And again, and then, that is what happens in Atoms. That's the end of that. So it's like, oh, a computer made this computer. Earth is just the computer that was an offcast of a different computer. Spoiler alert for those books. Sorry.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. Yeah. For these old books from 40 years. But yeah, he basically he says, oh, you know, we always listen to these predictability computers. They tell us what the best outcome is, and this is how we've done everything. And Cal starts to run back with all his relationship with the engineer and says, oh yeah, like he would never make a decision without knowing the predictability, like the statistics of what, you know, the stats of what could happen. And so he says, oh, well, so he looks and says, this is what's always happened. You've had this, they've attacked, you've retreated because that's always what's happened. They know you're going to do this. They're doing something different now, and it's thrown you for a loop. So you've got to do something different. And the best thing you can do that will scare the crap out of them is you will defend something, because they know that your predictability is to survive. You've got to retreat. So you've now got to attack and defend Earth, because it will confuse them back. This doesn't mean success. And I love the fact that, again, Warner says at the end of it, he says, it's not guaranteed. Like, it's giving us a chance. It's giving Earth a chance. But this isn't a victory. This is the first step. And the council agreed to it. And I was just like, boom.
It's amazing. I know. It's not. They're not necessarily. It's not. They're not going to be an A-team montage. Lots of people are going to die.
Yeah.
And it is. It was, again, I finished it late at night one night, a couple of weeks, whatever, you know, and I was like, it was, and I know we spent almost an hour just talking about this book, because it was a fucking journey, man.
Oh, it's amazing.
It was so good. I hope people have read along. And if you didn't read along, we have spoiled the fuck out of it.
Yeah.
It is a journey. It is thoughtful. I am 100% going to read it again.
Oh yeah. I think this is a book I'll come back to. There's so much, as you say, it's a roller coaster. But what I love about it is, what the because I picked up Armageddon 2419 AD.
Sure.
They paperback the formed Buck Rogers just the other day. And so I'm flicking through that, and I'm like, that's a white savior narrative. I love John Carter, right? I love the John Carter novels.
Yeah, yeah.
They're again the same thing.
Well, Burroughs is all about white savior, right?
Oh yeah, 100%.
Tarzan, John Carter. That's his whole thing. He did Conan books too, right? That's his whole thing.
He did some later, this idea is, but this book is the exact opposite. And I kind of love it for that, where it's like, you know, exactly like, you're not special, you're part of a machine, but that's not a bad thing. You can do a good job. That's the point. Like, you know, but you've got to have imagination, and you can enjoy what you do and all this stuff. But like, the fact that this book goes through so many things, the Hollywood, and we'll get there next.
Yeah.
The Hollywood interaction is to have yourself a Rex Reeson that goes off and becomes the hero. But this book is the exact opposite. The book's saying, no, there is no Rex Reeson. Like, you know, up in space, there's masses and masses of death. But there's no heroes. There's no Han Solos. There's no Luke Skywalkers. There's just soldiers and battles and death, and this is how it works. Like, you're part
Heinlein,
of
and again, I keep saying Heinlein read this. I mean, like, I know they were kind of writing at the same time, but like, look, I love Starship Troopers is borderline fascist how-to manual. And the reason that I love it is a fascist how-to manual.
I like the way you say borderline.
Okay, I don't want to offend all the Heinlein fans, but like, Heinlein's a borderline fascist, and like, but that's why the movie is so good, because.
Yes.
They're like, wah, ha, ha, ha. This is going to piss them off. We're going to actually, you said it in Argentina, and we know you're a fascist, and we're just going to actually cast white people, and we're going to really make fun of you. And I love everything about that film. And I've read, you know, and of course I've read Starship Troopers. I've read the books.
Yeah.
But like, it's this, and again, it's, but Heinlein again has read this idea. Like, and of course, when you think Roddenberry's whole thing is, this isn't about just a white savior. It's, what do we need? I mean, sure, you can say Kirk and Picard and, you know,
yeah,
but it's not. It's always the team.
Yes.
Especially when you get to my favorite Trek, Deep Space Nine, when you get to Voyager, you know, it's like you've got a captain. You need a captain, of course. And all the captains are awesome. I love all the captains. But, like, it's always the team. It's always the crew that solves the problem. And that is very, like, working together. Like, almost always the solution in Star Trek is either Kirk does something totally wacky and unpredictable, which is this, or they work together, which is also this.
Yeah.
It's bananas.
I just want to say one of the things, you know, I think we'll touch on this. There's been so many stories in this fantastic book.
Yeah.
That we've talked about in this series where I'm sorry, like you say, why are these not more widely known?
I don't know.
Why do people not talk? Why are they not being taught? Like, you know, this is a book. Like, in fact, I'm putting this to you now.
Yeah, Tony. I don't have a good answer. It will find its way into one of my courses without a doubt. I was disappointed until this project. I would never have read this. Because again, I saw the movie.
Yeah.
I saw the Mystery Science Theater 3000. If it's on, I'll stop and watch it for all of its silliness.
Let's jump into that then.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer, but I promise you I will work it in.
It's wonderful.
A lot of these stories in, because there's so much commentary. I think science fiction needs to be taught. And I think this book is amazing. Raymond F. Jones, I am going to see. I've not read anything else of his. That ends. I'm going to definitely go on a Raymond F. Jones rabbit hole.
I think this is fantastic. This has been the biggest joy and surprise of this series. I'm glad it's the finale for this.
I know, me too. Yeah.
Let's talk about the film. So 3 years later, in 1955.
Somebody read this book and was like, you know what's amazing about this book? Nothing. We're gonna throw that. Yeah, the part where they read an instruction manual and then we're gonna take a turn. Yeah. And it even says the poster's like 2.5 years in the making. Oh, well, is that because you were arguing with Jones? He's like, no.
Yes, you don't understand the book. Like, you've completely misunderstood, but where's my industrial action? Yes. In the book, so basically the first half of the film is exactly as we've said. It's basically you know, Cal is a pilot. I love the fact there's a great scene at the beginning where he's wearing like a full suit and then starts putting on like a pilot's outfit over the top of it.
And he flies that way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds incredibly uncomfortable, but there you go.
Yeah.
All the rest is there. Cal getting the, you know, the part, the Interoster being built, with his friend Joe.
Joe is there.
Yeah. And then, you know, exactly the same. Well done. We want you to join us. We're now going to destroy the machine. Planes arriving.
They decided to name him Exeter, which is a name you cannot say.
Yes.
And then, yeah.
I appreciated that.
Yes. Good change.
Yes, sensible. And then, so then a plane arrives. I like the fact they give it this extra element of, like, it's in dark and it's fog. And Joe says, nothing's landing in this. And all of a sudden the plane comes in and it's...
Yeah.
That's cool. I like them. The slight changes to be more visual. And then then he flies up. This is the bit that makes me laugh with this film because it's quite a short film. It's 85 minutes. He basically takes off, lands at this new place. He's met by Ruth.
Ruth.
So she's all in it. And she's a different kind of character. She's very 50s...
She's very Kate Capshaw.
Yes. A lot of screaming. Falling over.
My God, falling over. How did you get a doctorate in anything if you can't stand up? Like,
no.
Like running away, you had to like stand scrambling in the lab. Scrambling. I know, my God.
It was like an SNL skit at the end.
Yeah, that's well said.
But basically, like, where the book is like, he works for 6 months and then this happens and he works for a couple of more months and stuff. Like, it's protracted over a certain amount of time. And then you get the suspicions of weird things going on. He turns up, meets like this, you know, Al and Ruth. And then within 20 minutes, they're like, it's fucking weird here. It's really weird. And you're just like, what? Oh, yeah, no, it's don't trust anyone. And you're like, hang on, what? What? This is fast. Like, it's really like they're not messing around. Like, they're like, oh, we've got 85 minutes. We can't have a montage of him working. Let's get straight to it.
Yeah. Oh my God. And they it is yeah, it is definitely it, the whole thing takes, like, maybe there's one overnight. Like, he gets there, they have dinner. Yeah. It's Georgia instead of Arizona.
Yeah.
They have dinner. They're like, let's go to the lab. And the professor from Gilligan's Island is there, and he's just like casually blowing smoke in their face. And they go downstairs, and there's a cat, there's like a metal to, like, let's hide behind this lead because Superman. And then, but there's a cat, and the cat feels the vibrations. Oh, the cat Neutron gave us away. And then the next day, they're like, look at these pictures we had. We've been drawing sketches. See their big foreheads? Yeah, I can fucking see their big foreheads right there. Like, do you need to sketch their big foreheads for us to know? And then she even says, really proud of this one, Cal. Like, we couldn't do anything till you got here, Cal. Like, what the fuck? And then the next day...
That's it. They try to escape, and then they're being chased by Steve, a UFO.
The guy who the Ole character's name is Steve, and he gives himself up, or is he running away? Which is it?
He's just not very good at running away.
Because he's like, let's get out.
Yeah.
And that, like, why is that a good idea?
And he panics, and then sort of like, yeah.
And then he drives off and gets blown up. And I got to say, that was good special effects.
Oh, yeah.
The car blowing up was great looking.
I'm not going to deny, there's some good special effects in it. There's some terrible special effects as well.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
But yeah, they get blown up by this thing. They've seen a UFO taking off. And then when they get brought back, they basically go, we have to tell you the truth. We're at war. And we need you, Cal, because you're turning lead into uranium.
Right.
And we need your uranium because we need nuclear power, and we've run out of uranium on our planet.
And so what our solution is to take you, you and Ruth. Like, there's even a line is like, we need uranium. Well, did you bring any? Yeah. Did you bring anything with you? Like, how is bringing Cal with you?
Yeah. Instead of letting... Good. There's an intermediate result here. Instead of trying to turn lead into uranium, are you mining uranium?
Right. What about that choice? What? No. Oh, okay. Oh, okay. And so they go, like, there's a whole middle section. Like, well, it's really I guess it's sort of the second act is on a spaceship and for no reason. And they're wearing different type pants. And they sit in like these weird tubes. Cal says, I feel like a toothbrush. Like, it's just silly. It's just a silly thing. They're like chairs for no reason. Everything's metal. It's like, that's the cool thing. If we had a steel chair, that's from the future. That's from no one in
comfort
this world
is a thing
would
of
sit.
The past.
Yeah. Who wants a cushion? Yeah. I'm just going to sit on this steel bar. Yeah. That's even their chairs are stand up chairs with like a thing for your ass. I'm like,
to rest
ouch.
On. Yeah, that looks like it's going to be sciatica. That did look really uncomfortable.
No, thank you for that. Is that, I just put my. So it's this whole weird middle section that's taking itself. Like, I don't know. I can only imagine what somebody in 1955 thought. They were like, oh my God, that was the most amazing thing. I can't believe I didn't notice they were aliens with their big giant foreheads. Because the
orange as well.
Is,
I mean, they are Trump orange as well.
They are. But then when they get on the ship, because there's a black and white version and a color version. I watched the color version.
I watched the color version. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So when they get into the ship, they're purple.
Yes.
For no reason. Everybody's purple. Cal and Ruth are purple.
There is a reason. The reason they go into those tubes and they sort of there's a light
the
over
them. Pressure changes. That's
there's
right.
a pressure
yeah.
change and a slight atmosphere change, so they've got to be prepared for the planet. But when they
that's
come
right.
out, they're purple.
It's purple.
You're like, oh,
right.
Look,
you're like,
Violet,
it's
Violet
very,
Beauregard.
Yeah, very Oompa Loompa happening. But there's this scene before they leave, before they blow up their mansion, that Cal shows up, White Savior shows up, and 10 minutes later, the whole fucking place blows up. There's a there's a German guy and a Japanese guy and a Swedish lady. They're all dead. They're all dead now. Good job, Cal. And but you learn that Exeter, he's got a sidekick called Brack, and they are contentious because Exeter believes in humans, but Brack believes in the mission, which is. Like you said, there's always somebody in charge, which is to treat this island Earth, to use us as a resource. That's the only moment in the movie that remotely remembers what the book was about. That, humans, we're using the humans as a resource. We're using Earth as a resource. But in this, there's one guy, Exeter, who likes humans enough to save two of them.
Yeah. But
Adam and Eve.
Yeah. You get the annoying thing, and I've sort of, I hate this trope now. There may have been a time in my life that I'd accept it, but now I just detest it as a trope. Is this thing of going sort of like, they're a resource. No, humans are good. They create beauty and things. We should save the humans.
But Mozart, there's a conversation about Mozart.
Yes, exactly. Yes. There's always that sort of thing. And I'm not going, I'm a human. I've said, no, like, we're not. If you can leave the rest. I watch the news on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Like, I've seen we're really not doing well. If anything, kill us off and leave the planet. I'm all for that at this point. Like, you know,
Well, there's a line, because obviously Men in Black stole a lot from the book as well, right?
Yes.
Like the mind wiping and stuff. And the mind wiping is in the movie too.
Oh, the mind wiping paper. That's a great idea as well. Sorry, that was a fantastic
one. I know. Oh my God. But there's a line in the original Men in Black, which I think they're all fine, but that first one is so good. When they're sitting there and Tommy Lee Jones, because Will Smith says, well, you could tell people about this. People are smart. And he's like, no, a person is smart.
Yes.
People are stupid.
Yes. I love that line.
As a group.
Yeah.
You're crazy.
Yeah.
Is smart. Yeah. And that is in the book, right? That is happening. And that's sort of what the movie's trying to say with what you're saying is like, but again, it could be that, but the movie's trying to say the opposite, which is no, people are good. And you're like, no, people aren't.
People suck. Just,
Mozart is good. People are dumb.
Right? Yes, exactly. so you get this thing back and forth. You've got this other person, the captain of the ship, who's obviously also purple.
Yeah.
And it kind of just goes round and round, like you say, and then they get to the planet. This is the bit that makes no sense to me, because they keep saying how important Cal is, but they go to their home planet, and they're being bombarded by this.
Sentient comets.
Sentient comets. Now, that thought was Starship Troopers, when you got, like, the ass blaster kind of, like, alien, you know, when they're blasting comets that hit Earth. And one hits Costa Rica and stuff, which starts the bug war. Which, complete side note, there's a whole theory that actually the bugs never sent that. It was actually one of the characters. There's a section of the film where they hit an asteroid by accident and it sets it off.
I totally believe that.
Which I think is an even better satire.
Verhoeven is, as we know, as a satirical genius. Yeah, so I believe that completely,
But yeah, why take the person that's so important to you to a planet that's been bombarded? We're like, we have to live underground now because the planet's been destroyed.
What?
Yeah.
There's no reason other than they needed to get them to this thing, and they needed the woman who plays Ruth, Faith Domaru, who's, you know,
she's fine.
She's fine, but it's just tough because we just watched The Thing and Hawk's Thing from Another Planet, the woman, and then in the remake of The Thing, you've got two, like, competent women doing things, and in this one, you've got, like, Kate Capshaw, you got Willie Scott shrieking. Boy, she must really love her husband, because he made her do that. Like, I've seen Kate Capshaw not be bad, but, like, Willie Scott is the worst. So you know she's acting. You know that was a choice that they were making. It's like, why does Indiana Jones like her?
This is the comedy one. That kind of thing.
The 11-minute supercut of Willie Scott screaming is worth finding on the internet. It's awful. That's all she is. That's all that Ruth Adams is in this. And it's, again, you've made her Dr. Adams. You've given her that agency and then just taken away. Like, she can't walk. So then they go to the other planet. They fight the mutant, which, again, is a person in a bug suit. He's wearing, like, track pants.
Yeah.
He's dressed. And they put, like, Warlock pinchers on his hand, and then just a big brain. Like, again, obviously, Tim Burton's aliens are like, that's funny. Let's do that. It's just that. It's just explain to me the evolutionary. And I know they're saying he's a mutant. So is the argument that that was one of them? Like, the reason the brain is so big?
No, they say he's from a different planet, and he was like, he's like an insect from your planet, but he's a mutant. So he's an alien insect that's been mutated, which you go, okay.
Why is he there?
But we have many of them. Basically, he's got a big brain, but they're kind of stupid. This one's been programmed to protect this corridor, and he takes it very seriously.
Very seriously. Like flying monkeys level of serious. Yeah. And that's about the motivation that he has, too. And it just, it looks cool, and he's menacing. So then they fight him. I wouldn't trust my grandma. Cal has to punch Exeter.
Everybody, yeah.
Because, again, like you said, you've got Rex Reason, and he's handsome. So he's got a very, he's handsome,
very
white guy.
Sort of square jawed American, isn't he? Like, there's no one more 50s than Rex Reeson at this point.
There is not. No. Oh my God. I know. It's like, he's like, God damn you, Errol Flynn, for existing before me. Like, that's his whole thing. And, you know, he is that. And so, yeah. So they do this. They fight the bug. They get back on the spaceship. There's a line earlier that's like, oh, well, because she's like, how do you handle the gravity? And he's like, oh, well, we have a special flingity flong flong. So whenever we turn upside down, you stay upright. Except 5 minutes later in the movie, when we turn, we're not upright. Yeah. We turn. So it's like, why have that line? And then he's like, Cal, as a scientist, don't you want to know? Ruth, as a woman, aren't you curious? That's the line. Movie?
Yeah.
God damn you, movie. And I understand why Mystery Science Theater 3000 did it, and especially after reading the book. Like, I thought the movie was kind of hokey or whatever, but now that I've read the source material, I'm just even more disappointed. Yeah. I'm not sad, movie. I'm just disappointed. Well,
there's something I want to ask about the ending. I really have. So, the ending of the film is Exeter basically sort of saves them and says, you're probably better off on Earth. I'm going to take you back, because everyone's been destroyed on our planet. So he takes them back to Earth. They've had a plane because they were trying to escape in a plane.
Right,
that's how they were,
right.
That's how they were taken.
Up tractor beam.
Yep. Their plane went green and they were taken up into a tractor beam. So he takes them back to Earth. They fly away at the bottom of the ship. Exeter's dying. And then they're like, are you going to be okay? He's like, I could travel the galaxies and find people more like me. And they're like, no, you're dying. He's like, yes, I am. And then they let him go. And then it crashes into the sea.
It does.
Up, crashes into the sea. That's the end. Now, I'm thinking, right? So here's the thing. Well, you know that on their home planet, there was another planet. They've been at war for generations.
Yep.
So that other planet's won.
Yes.
That's the end of the film.
That's the end of the film.
Yeah.
The only thing I thought was fun, because again, we're in this whole weird interconnected universe. I was like, oh, well, maybe it would have been fun for that, you know, because that ship, the opening of Carpenter's The Thing, is that shot of the flying saucer flying in. So I'm like, oh, this is Exeter. This is their people. That's it. That it ends on a downer. But the best thing is that Cal and Ruth get to cuddle. He's flying a plane one-handed while they cuddle. The end. And it's the weirdest edit. It's like, they drop out of a plane in a bi-wing plane, like a bi-propelled. They drop straight down and somehow fly. I'm like, okay. And then, like, stunt pilot style. And then there's, like, even the music cues are like, dun-dun-dun, Exeter's dying. The plane, his spaceship is literally flaming out. I mean, it's like, and then cut to, like, boopity boop boop produce jazz, and then cut back to this back and forth, and then it ends on a downer. And because it's 1955, the credits are all at the opening, right? So it's just the end. Exeter's planet is dead.
Lights
he
up.
He dies into the ocean. Somebody may find a flying saucer off the coast of wherever they are.
Yes,
we assume the east. We don't know which coast they go back to.
No. But that's the end.
Amazing.
And,
and
then they fly off, and, you know, Rex Reeson just sort of, chisel jaws his way into another job. I watched the film first.
Oh.
So I was like,
well, I have two in the world, but this time I read the book first. Sure, I hear you. Okay.
So I watched the film first, and I was like, cool. Okay. It's a typical, very linear, very straightforward 1950s science fiction film. All right. I'm thinking When Worlds Collide, and, you know, Earth versus the Flying Saucers and all that kind of stuff. Right.
Yeah. Ants. You guys did Ants.
We did.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking of all those and go, this fits into that camp. Right. This is very much of that sort of, like, the heroic America of the 50s versus an other, an external other. Right. Cool. It's not good, though. Like, the dialogue's clunky. The acting is crap in most parts. Like, the story's although it's fast-paced, it still takes a long time to get anywhere.
Not in a good way.
And not in a good way.
Yeah, not in a character-building way. And in a, these people suck, can we get to something else way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was really dreading. I was thinking, I was looking, this is 120 pages in real future. I'm like, I'm really dreading reading this. And so, yeah, within like 30, 40 pages of reading the book, I was like, how the hell did that film come from this book?
I have no idea. I really genuinely don't know. I don't know. The world, and again, the world maybe wasn't ready for it, but we know that Roddenberry allowed for that. And like when you think about Clark and Asimov, there it took a long time for their stuff to get made. And yeah, again, yeah. I'm not a big Kubrick stan, and I think, you know, 2001 is beautiful, but I don't think it's a great film. I'd rather read the book.
Yeah.
Because again, I think Kubrick likes to miss the point of every book he adapts. That's his thing. He's like, I can make it look cool. You for sure. God, it's shot so beautifully and it's creepy in the music, boy. But like, I don't know that you read the source material.
One day we'll rant about The Shining. But
I just did. I'm going to be on Kyle's. We did Night Shift. We just did The Shining, and we shit on it for a while. When that comes out, I'll send you a link. It was a good time. Yeah, that's that. Oof, that's a even if you haven't read the book, I don't know how you see The Shining or like, that was great. That made perfect sense. It's like this. It's like so slow to start to get nowhere.
Yes.
And then things that escalated quickly. Like that could have been said about this film.
But it's literally, but it escalates just quickly. Everybody. Yeah, it escalates quickly because they're like, oof, we got 30 minutes left. We better do something.
This had an $800,000 budget in 1955.
Wow.
What the fuck? So they used it all on the bug suit and the special effects, and that's why the rest of it is like, let's just stand around on the soundstage?
Yeah.
I it's really bad. I don't know. I don't know how they read it and were like, let's take... Because again, sometimes... Like, I'm all for adaptation. I'm not... Like, the new Spiderwick Chronicles are out. I haven't watched it yet. But I'm gonna... Because I like the Spiderwick books. I read them when I was a kid. Christian Slater's in it. I'm always a big fan.
Mm-hmm.
They had African-American family this time. That's fine. It's fiction. That's good. Like, when they cast Jesse Martin on Flash, so then they needed to have a, you know, an African-American woman play Iris because you picked Joe West as a black guy, so you gotta have... That's fine. I didn't care. Like, I understand that comic book Irish West is a pacey redhead. That's okay. She's fictional. My feelings aren't hurt about that. Like, I'm pro adaptation. I write adaptations. I love Clueless. It's glorious. Like, I'm all for, like, The Lion King is the best way to get kids to understand Shakespeare. Like, adaptation is great.
But they have to be good.
They have to be. All these things I'm listing are good.
That's the thing
this
I was about
is
to get.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't choose. We gave it props. The choices that it made, Exeter instead of Jorgens Arva.
Yeah, fine.
That's a good choice. That's it. That's the one good choice.
But even we have literally been talking about adaptation throughout this whole series. Like, you know,
correct.
You know, yes, you can get to Death Race from
the
Racer.
Yeah, easy. You see it.
Yeah, all right. But it's an extension of an idea, and you know, Corman and Co. sort of like pulled from it. Who goes there becomes Thing from Another World and The Thing, and you read it and you go, yeah, I can see both of those coming from this. They are adaptations, and I like them for different reasons.
Correct.
I prefer The Thing over it, but like I can see the purpose. Even what was it, the Rear Window and that one, like
all quite those a bit bits different.
Quite a bit different,
but still very good.
But both of them,
both are good.
So
you can see how Hitchcock was like, "Oh, what if?"
Exactly. How do I turn this into a visual? That
right.
Kind of thing.
Exactly.
But this is the one where I'm like, "Wow, yeah,
wow."
Even like 8 o'clock in the morning, they went right. That was an idea, but we're going to add Roddy Piper. And
well, but with 8 o'clock in the morning, they understood the idea. That's a six-page story.
Yeah.
And it ends the same. Hero dies at the end. It's still a downer. It's still a heroic. He's not a white savior. He dies. No. Like, Carpenter got it. And talk about a slow beginning that gets you somewhere.
Yes.
You know, there's a huge, and again, this book, this is a slow beginning that gets you somewhere. You spending time with Cat, like you said, the fact that opening line, it's very Shirley Jackson, like it's, and nobody starts, I will say forever, nobody starts anything like Shirley Jackson, but like you get a lot of meat in these first three paragraphs, and that is great writing. And I don't know what they were thinking. It's just like, why you owned the title, This Island Earth. But was it because historically, like, I don't know, we can't go back in time to know, was it super popular at the time that they felt they had to buy the name. It isn't like The Shining. I don't understand.
No, I can't seem to find anything that says this was like a super popular book.
Right.
It was popular enough that the serialization was collected into book form.
Correct.
So that tells us there was an audience for it, but I don't. There's nothing that says like this was a runaway success and sold thousands and thousands of copies.
Right.
It was appealing to a specific audience of, you know, 1950s sci-fi audience. But yeah, this wasn't like a mainstream hit in that sense. Like
the fact that you choose to adapt it and just bastardize it again, I don't know what you were thinking about. It's almost like the filmmakers hated the writer.
They did. No. I think the filmmakers, I think they got the rights to this. They then read it and were like, oh, this is kind of complex and a roller coaster ride. That's not what we want to do. We want to make another hero, chisel jawed hero, 50s sci fi film, B movie. That's what we're looking to do.
Right. Because I think if you make it today, if you cast it today, like if we're making it now, the Cal Meacham character. And I would say not anymore because now he's all jacked and looks about it. But like you need like a Dev Patel, like you need not 2024 Dev Patel, but like 2016 Dev Patel. You need like that, like,
yes,
newsroom Dev Patel, right? You're like, that's the guy who you need to be Cal. You're like, he's smart, he's charming, he's charismatic, he's handsome, he does all the things, but he's also like, his brain is going to solve the problem. He doesn't have to, you know, do what obviously
Monkey
he's
Man.
Done now. I can't wait to see that, by
no,
the way.
I see it. Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like, that's who you cast for your hero now, is that kind of unassuming kind of, you know.
Do you know what this is? Do you know what this is now? This is a four-part limited series, premium series on
yes,
HBO,
I'd watch the fuck
Apple.
Out of that. Yeah.
Where each episode, all of a sudden, you're like, oh my God, it's about this. And then the next episode, they're like, no, it's about this. And then it keeps sort of like beating you around the head and going, it's something else, it's something else.
To do it, you couldn't call it This Island Earth because of the connotation, because Mystery Science Theater and because the movie's so hokey. If you were to adapt it,
you think you could
get away with it?
I think you could reclaim it.
Oh, reclaim it. It deserves it, man.
It
deserves to be reclaimed. It is, of all of these, of our whole series, for the most part, like you said, I like the film. I liked all the stories. Not one of these stories was bad.
No.
In every case, I think the film, not improved, but expanded a really good idea. Like, I think 8 o'clock in the morning stands on its own. I think Thing from Other Planet stands on its own. But I think also like these, or, you know, Who Goes There stands on its own. But I think like the films improve on it. Not that third, the thing, improve on it. Candyman, right? Candyman, I think the movie's actually better. Sorry, Barkerheads, but I think the movie's better.
I think it's I agree. I think
but the story is good. If the story exists, you'd be like, that story is great.
Yeah.
Right. But I just personally, that's me on that one. But this, hands down, this book is so good and the movie is so bad. Like, I don't know, now that I've read the book, I could ever watch the regular version of the movie again without the robots. I don't know, because it's so stupid. It's so insulting.
Yeah. No, this needs to be reclaimed.
Yeah, it's so good. I cannot stress enough to people. I will send you the PDF so you can include a link in the show notes.
Yeah.
But you can get it. I found the PDF. I have it. It is so worth a read. I'm so glad we did this, because again, we were both dreading this, probably thinking like, oh my God, I can't believe we saved it for the end because of all of the hype of the movie. But I'm so glad we did, because it was just a hidden gem. Now, I've not read the Buck Rogers story in here yet.
Ah,
You bought the standoff.
Because,
right.
Yeah, because actually I will quickly get it. So what it is in here, you have in the book, we have Armageddon 2419.
Yeah.
I picked this up. This is the 1962 Panther Press edition.
Oh,
I picked this up in a secondhand bookshop the other day. And I saw it and I was like, ooh, what this book does, there were two books written, and this collects the first two stories of not book, but Anthony Rogers, Tony Rogers,
Nice.
And puts them into a single edition.
Got it.
And yes, before he became Buck Rogers, he became Buck Rogers in the comic strip, which came out
Okay.
A couple of years later. But what I love about this has a foreword by Robert A. W. Lowndes, not a name I really know.
No.
It has a follow-up, as an afterword by Harry Harrison. And I Harry Harrison. Do you know the name?
I've heard that name.
Okay. Harry Harrison wrote The Stainless Steel Rat, who's a character in it. So who is a character one day we will talk about, who is a futuristic thief. It's a sort of a comedy parody. He's a futuristic thief that ends up always doing good.
So he's like Booster Gold.
Yes, pretty much. Before, well, I think Booster Gold may have been around, but like it dates back. So I would love to, we will, one of the days I'd love to talk about this. So yes, there's also like The Fly is in this book, which I'm going to read because I've never and actually
obviously
read that.
The Sentinel is in this.
The Sentinel we talked about, obviously, for 2001.
Yeah, yeah.
We obviously got The Illustrated Man, not so big on that.
He wrote, I know the name. He wrote the book, the story upon which Soylent Green was based.
Oh, yes.
That,
yes.
So that clicked. I was like, why do I know the name? That was why. Okay.
So the other...
It's people.
If we do this in the future, and I think we were coming back, we've got a summer where we will talk about... Yeah. The three I really want to do is Air Raid, which is the last story in the book, which became the film Millennium, which is a really unknown film from 1990, but I love. I haven't seen it in years, but I kind of love that. It's about a plane crash, but like they can't seem to justify why the plane crashed. And it's interesting. Enemy Mine, which...
I love that. Yeah, I'm here for that. Yeah, yeah.
And I want to do Damnation Alley, but for possibly a different reason.
Okay.
Because Damnation Alley became a film, but Damnation Alley also inspired and was very influential on the Cursed Earth saga for Judge Dredd.
Nice.
Pat Mills cites that heavily for the Cursed Earth.
Nice.
So we'll have to do that. But the other one we're going to do, and I'm thinking we need to bring in our brother from another mother.
He loves those. I know. He loves this book. He loves this movie as much as I do.
Bod from another pod. We're going to be bringing in Julian Darris, I think, to do it. Because in the summer, we are going to do a Hudson Hawk story.
Because there is a novelization. Because everybody remember.
No. Let's be clear. It's not a novelization. It's a source novel.
The source novel, right. Because Bruce Willis wrote an idea. Then this person wrote the novel.
Yes, a novel by Geoffrey Marsh. It's not based on a script. It's based on an idea that was then became the script. But what's interesting...
Because the guys from Heathers wrote Hudson Hawk.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So I want to see how different this is because Geoffrey Marsh does not get a credit in the film.
He does not at all. So no. But they do have Bruce's picture on the cover. And I openly love Hudson Hawk. You can listen to me wax poetic about Hudson Hawk on Spider Dan and the Secret Boars on Secret Defenders.
I have that episode. I know you're.
I'm all here for that. You give me Hudson Hawk all day long. My cousin who I'm going to go see in a couple of weeks. I tortured him I made him see it, and he has always said he's forever thankful because he's like, that movie looks dumb. I'm like, no, you got to sit and watch it with me. And to this day, there are still certain Hudson Hawk quotes that we say. And he loves it. So I'm making my next pick for VHS Strikes Back will be Hudson Hawk. I can't wait for Chris to hate it.
He's going to hate it.
He's going to hate it. So
it's one
much.
Of my favorite Richard E. Grant performances.
Oh, and Richard E. Grant hates it, but he
is amazing in it.
Amazing. He and Sandra Bernhardt, like need their spinoff movie. I know they, spoiler alert, but I need their prequel.
The prequel. Yeah.
I'm all for the Minerva prequel, like when they meet each other. Oh,
excellent.
Yeah, I'm here
so we're
for
looking
that.
Forward right. to that. But yes. There you go. But before we go, obviously, you got some big stuff coming. Where can people find you and the stuff
sure.
you're doing?
Sure. ARFarina.com is the place to be. So I've got pre-orders are out for the of that other Dashwood Girl, the Austin Chronicles book 2. The pre-order for Comics Lit Volume 1 is out now, where it's myself and Tanya edited. We both write essays and a bunch of nerds. We defend comics as high art. Volume 2 will feature Mr. Scott Weatherly, who he wasn't in volume one because he was busy editing something that took him away. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that thing that kept you busy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So says what I've done. I've got, there's obviously two books. We obviously did the original Judge Dredd book. We did the Moon Knight book, which is what was taking me at the time.
Yeah.
That is now out. Yes. Waxing and Waning. So that is obviously out there. About always links on the website. I am now working on some other stuff. We've got some other essays coming up. We have got one coming up for Stories Out of Time and Space, which I'm currently working on.
And you guys are working on Stories Out of Time and Space essay collection.
Essay collection.
I'm so excited about that.
And I've also worked on two essays on pulp heroes for a book coming out at some point, probably late this year, early next, called Pulp to Present, which I'm very excited about. And yeah, obviously we'll do the podcast. All the Patreon as well. We've literally, it'll be coming out soon, but Julian and I have now finished trekking through the Twilight Zone. We have watched every single episode of the original Twilight Zone and talked about them. And it's been an absolute journey. So worth checking out, because that's like hours of content of us talking about
America's
Twilight Zone.
Greatest science fiction writer.
Yeah, Rod Serling. My opinion. Does some great. Yeah, Rod Serling. Yeah. The man's a dude. Anyway, so yes, so go check those out. But for now, thank you, Tony, for this whole series.
It's been a treat. I mean, seriously, every time it's been a joy. I love reading the source material. I'm so glad we own these books, and I can't recommend everybody enough to go get your hands on this. If you can get Real Future.
Yeah, get Real Future. I want to see copies of this going for £150 on eBay, because they're so sought after after this.
After this, they should be 100%.
Anyway, we should let you go. Tony, it's been a treat. I've enjoyed it. And ladies and gentlemen,
thank you, friend.
We shall see you on the next episode.